Today's program is brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheese that win more awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network, broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Amanda Smeltz, head sommelier at Balloud Sud and Bar Balloud in New York City. We'll talk to Amanda about wine lists, what we should be drinking now, and some underappreciated wine regions and styles. We'll also taste a Riesling from Germany on the weekly wine sip. I'm Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. All right, before I get into Amanda's intro, I want to read you a little something. Tonight, I am too stupid to write a poem. Who knows what poetry is? I know. My voice is too pronounced. My pronoun is a needless gnome. I fall asleep in the spelling quiz and sink to the shipwrecks and fathoms below. On the Titanic, mosses grow. The moon has been renounced and burning tigers pounce.
Right off the Golden Gate.
Your poetry must obfuscate or end up middle brow. Madonna says, take a bow.
That's a really weird thing to have somebody do to you, Sam.
That is part of a poem, Crown for a Natural Disaster. It goes on by our guest, Amanda Smeltz. Amanda not only has a deep passion for wine, but she's a published poet. And I know that's a passion of hers. Amanda Smeltz is the head sommelier of Wine Bar Bar Balloud and restaurant Balloud Sud near Lincoln Center, New York City, part of the Daniel Balloud Dynex Group. Welcome to the Grape Nation.
Thanks, Sam.
Amanda. Did I pick a good poem?
That's one of my favorites I've ever written, actually. Yeah.
It's pretty cool. That's why I picked it.
Thank you.
I would have read the whole thing.
It's a
long one, but we'll talk about that.
Okay.
So I ask all my guests to tell us about your journey in life and in wine, on how you got to where you are today, which right now is at the Balloods.
Yeah.
So without going too long
or
whatever, because I think you have a colorful background and it'll give us some context as we get into stuff.
In some ways I think my journey into wine has been a pretty, it's representative because I studied the humanities and the liberal arts and, you know, I picked up a joke from a philosophy friend of mine who said, you know, when you study the humanities, the work is always pro bono. So you have to find a way to, you know, you become your own patron. If you practice,
you gotta get a job.
Yeah, you have to have a job. Right. And so, I worked in restaurants since I was a kid. I started working in small, like mom and pop restaurants when I was 14. And,
you grew up where?
Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. So just like a little kind of like dairy farm type restaurants, you know. And then when I was in college, I had a very intelligent and sort of food knowledgeable roommate who started to teach me how to cook. And I was like fascinated by her. She knew people like, you know, Julia Child from the time she was little. And she was like, you know, you really should try fine dining. And she's like, if you're curious about this stuff, you already work in restaurants. Just make the hop. So I did. And I was studying philosophy in undergrad at the time. And I got really lucky. I started working at a fine dining restaurant where the GM had opened Gramercy Tavern.
Wow. And,
yeah, he was on the opening staff there, and he was not only the GM, but the, you know, wine buyer. And he was like...
Who was it?
His name was Peter Donahue.
And did he stay on for a while at the beginning?
Yeah, oh yeah. He was, I think, their first technical wine buyer sommelier, you know.
Right.
So he remembers when Paul Greco got hired and kind of all,
what,
you know, he's really close with Tom Colicchio. And
right.
So I got really lucky by accident to have this mentor who was, you know, Gramercy, like, OG. And he said, you know, you seem bored, kid, and you're smart. Like, here, learn a thing, you know. And I said, okay, because I, you know, he recognized that I'm the kind of person where if I'm not given enough to learn or to do, I get restless and troublesome. So he started to teach me wine.
Nice.
Yeah, and it just became something. He said this remarkable thing that has always stayed with me, that wine is anthropology. And so it's become this lens through which I get to look at all the stuff that I love anyway, and there's the added, you know, pleasure of being able to eat and drink, you know. So it's
a good perspective.
Yeah.
Not everyone has that perspective.
Yeah.
So that leads you where?
So it led me to New York, where I had always wanted to move anyway, and then I was beginning a graduate degree, so it totally made sense to kind of keep doing the wine thing as the way to pay the bills. And
a grad degree to pursue your writing stuff?
Yeah, exactly. So I got an MFA at the New School in Manhattan for in poetry, yeah. And during that time, I was also working on kind of pushing the wine thing forward. So I started working at the Breslin and the John Dory.
Bloomfield.
Exactly. So I was working for April Bloomfield with Carla Rzewski, who became the wine director at those two restaurants.
Carla's a good person
to
work under.
So much fun. We had a great time. And so I worked with her for a couple of years.
We'll talk about that in a few minutes.
Yeah. And then that's kind of, you know, it's gone on from there.
So we broadcast our show live from Roberta's.
Mm-hmm.
You spent about 4 years at the wine program here.
Yes.
And you just recently left. And in the intro, I said you're with the Daniel Balud Group. You left the middle of last year to go to Bar Balud. All right, so let's talk about the early days, Roberta's, and all of that stuff. So I guess your influences early on were the guy, I forgot his name, from
Donahue
and Carla.
Yeah.
Right? So what were those influences? I mean, what did you take away from Carla after working side by side with
her? Sure. Well, it's kind of funny. I always say I feel a deep sort of spiritual connection with Gramercy Tavern, because all of the people who have been, you know, older than me or mentors to me, or, you know, people who have kind of guided me along, have been kind of deeply tied to Gramercy. So both Paul Greco and Juliet Pope have also been, even though I've never worked for them, they've also been extremely encouraging and have provided a lot of counsel kind of over the years. And Carla worked for Paul Greco at Hearth for a brief stint. So through Carla, I also had this funny, you know, I became closer to Paul Greco as a result.
So that means you have an affinity for Riesling.
Yeah, it's a heritage thing.
Paul Greco is one of the great sommelier cheerleaders for Riesling.
Yeah, yeah. And working with Carla was, so Peter gave me my whole kind of service perspective, and I learned essentially the Gramercy model of service.
Which is the best.
I think so, still.
Yep.
Just so human and really like...
Employee first.
Yep.
Happy employee brings a happy customer.
And I also learned, and this is great for me because it's something I cherish, that the spirit of education in restaurants is something I think that's deeply changing this industry. And it's also opening wine up to a completely new world of people who otherwise would have been like, it's just fussy. Like, it's just for fancy rich people, you know?
Right. That's not your view.
No, not at all.
You're an educator. And again, we'll talk about that. So you're working at the Breslin, you're working at John Dory, you're talking pork, pig to snout, and seafood.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's about as wide a variety of wine.
You couldn't ask for a more fun gig as a somm, really.
Are you pairing wines to the type of foods?
Yeah,
because
totally.
Some of the Breslin stuff was out there.
It's intense. I mean, the cool thing about what Carla got to do there, and then because of working on the program along with her, was that with those two different restaurant concepts, she got to build two completely different wine lists. So the style of wines on the list were utterly different. And at the Dory, it was a ton of really cool white wine from all over and lots of cool champagne and bubbles. So that those are big, broad categories that I love. So I got, you know, it's oysters and it's raw seafood and it's you know, kind of really unique pairing stuff. And then at the Breslin, it's such hearty and intense and like meat driven food that you learn a lot about how to use wine to be able to do a whole pig trotter, you know?
What were predominant wines at Breslin? Were they Rhone wines? Were they big, heavy reds?
What was the feature there? Yeah, big reds were common, especially because that's what people would ask for.
Right.
You know, like a lot of people have it in their head, if you're eating heavy meat, you do heavy red. But we snuck a lot of stuff onto that list that actually makes for really amazing pairings. Like I still have in my head one of my favorite pairings that we ever did there that was so kind of like mind numbing was April's famous trotter, which I'm like, you can't see it right now, but I'm holding up my forearm because it was quite literally that big.
Wow.
And you know, the whole foot is still on the trotter, like all the knuckles and the gelatin and stuff inside the foot. The whole thing gets breaded and then pan fried, and it's just giant.
So what pairs well with that?
A 1985 Veuve Clicquot Rosé. It was remarkable.
Champagne basically can go with anything.
It's really incredible. And it was the fact that it was aged and rosé, and the things that it did with all that pig fat was pretty awesome.
Sounds great.
Yeah.
So at some point you leave there.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Time to move on?
Yeah, I had done a couple years with them, and I, you know, was antsy, so I spent a little time in San Francisco trotting around and came back after about 6 months.
You didn't love the West Coast, huh?
I didn't.
What was it about it?
I try not to admit that too openly.
The lifestyle, people,
No.
Pace?
I mean, San Francisco is, it's visually stunning.
It's a real city.
It's one of the most beautiful places you could hope to ever see.
But?
But, you know, I was raised in the East Coast, and I'm kind of a loud mouth, and, you know, I think that...
let's not go crazy here. Harrisburg is on the East Coast, but...
Yeah.
But you spent a lot of time in New York. Go ahead.
Yeah.
I just took a shot at you.
Yeah. It's like if you're from the Mid-Atlantic at large, I think.
I'm joking.
You know,
the
Bay Area of California is
so
a
you come back
thing.
From San Fran.
Yeah.
And then what happens?
So a really good buddy of mine was the chef de cuisine here at Roberta's at the time. And, you know, I was...
What year are we talking?
2012.
So things are going here.
Yeah.
They got
it
going then.
Yeah. It was about a year or two after the famous Sam Sifton review of Roberta's had come out that just sort of blew the doors on this place wide open. And my buddy Maxie was in the kitchen at that time. And he said,
Maxie Sussman.
Indeed.
Whose brother Eli does a show here now.
That's exactly right.
And they have a pretty good resume themselves, those guys.
Yeah, totally.
And good guys.
They're the sweetest dudes. I think what a great set of brothers. And they also have an adorable baby boy in their lives. No, too. Anyway, so Max was in the kitchen and it had found out that I got back to town and was like, hey, we're still looking for a wine director here because the previous one had left and they had gone without one for 6 or 9 months or so. So I said, well, you know, he's like, do you want me to put you in touch with our GM? I said, yeah. And I loved their GM right away and was like, this is it.
So he came on to here.
The one for me.
2012.
Yep.
And you get here. You said there was nobody here for months.
Yeah, that's right.
So what state is the wine program in? And then I know a lot happened.
Uh-huh.
You know, where'd you take it? So
sure.
Any
restaurant that doesn't have a wine director in place for 9 months or whatever, it's going to be, you know.
They're just reordering.
There was a whole cellar of stuff that I had to kind of go in there and be like, what is all this? You know, and that's common. I think that's a common thing that happens.
So even though there was no attention paid to it, how evolved was the list?
Well, the previous woman who was here, a woman named Krista, had built a really, I think, handsome little Italian list, and it was full of kind of unique grape varieties and stuff. But I just had it in my head that you could totally blow the thing wide open
so
if you wanted
you
to.
So you were open to blowing it open. Mm-hmm. So what changes?
Well, I started slowly. You know, I started... slowly shifting the Italian selections and kind of diversifying those a little bit. And then, you know, I told the guys, the owners up front, I was like, I don't think you should have an all Italian wine list. And they were like, why? You know? And I was like, because this isn't an Italian restaurant. I'm like, yeah, you know, pizza's the linchpin, but you guys are cooking like new California food. You know what I mean? It's like Alice Waters riffs in here and heritage meat and like all, you know, all this stuff. I'm like, you've got background from all over. You do pasta incredibly well, but like there's all this other stuff going on. So it's like you should have wine from all over the world here. Like this is an American restaurant.
So that played in big, but also the environment here.
Totally.
I mean, this is a unique place.
Yeah. It's
so you also want to be different and hip too.
For sure.
Like, let's take some shots here.
For sure. Well, and I think it wasn't in my head clearly at first, but I knew that. Like, the reason I was so happy to be in this restaurant was that it's such a pirate ship. It's just like, it's like ramshackle, but you know, as you know, it's a pirate ship, and I loved that. I was like, well, you know, what does it look like when you do wine on a pirate ship? You know, and it just means like no rules. You know, no holds barred. And it means, like, carry things people don't know what they are and play.
So did they become supportive in letting you make the changes and giving you some capital to make the purchases?
Totally, totally.
So what were the immediate shifts? The wine list was predominantly Italian. Mm-hmm. You started taking it to what places?
The States first.
So you went domestic?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep. And then slowly started to build, you know, part of it was having to educate the staff. And that for me was like a big deal. It was, you know, if you're going to add a brand new massive program into a restaurant, you need to give people the tools to understand what the hell you're doing.
So I guess now's a good time to bring it up. You started like a staff wine class.
Mm-hmm.
Where you would sit people down and focus them on what you were doing and what was going on.
Yeah, exactly.
And that was the education part that you like.
Yeah.
So you were able to educate, sort of get the wines out.
Yeah, I mean, you have to fight with staff first. First, you have to convince them
they
that
don't
it's actually
give a crap.
Nah, of course. No one does until they do. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
you're just irritated that you're being dragged to a training.
Right.
And that it's being made mandatory once a month. And you know, it's like having to go to the dentist or pay taxes at first. And then you understand that you're being given a little gift, you know, that's like you walk into a liquor store, you have no idea what any of this stuff is, but you want to drink something and you have to randomly pick a thing off the shelf with really having no way to discern whether or not it's going to be any good. And sometimes you get lucky and it's good. And other times you're just like,
almost like
taste
a book.
It. Yeah. You know, like it tasted like nothing.
And people go by the cover or the label, which is bullshit.
Well, it's a terrible idea, right? So, you know, you end up kind of spending your money at random and you don't really get to drink anything that great unless you get lucky. So it's like, listen, I'm here teaching you because I want this wine program to have articulate people on it, right? But also, I'm giving you a gift. Like, you can now go to a restaurant or to a liquor store and actually maybe take a stab at something. And eventually people turn on to that and they're like, oh, this is actually kind of cool, you know? And I think a lot of people don't know how much like storytelling there is in wine and how much history there is.
Well,
and that catches people.
The amount of history and storytelling is amazing. It's how much you want to, you know,
how much
talk
you're interested,
about,
yeah.
They're interested in all that. So at some point, people start paying attention, gets traction. You could see your people are on the floor, you know, telling stories and all that.
It's, man, that is like one of the central pleasures, I think, in what wine and restaurants can do is when you see people who work there enjoying their job. That's just like the best feeling when you're like, oh, this doesn't have to be something I have to do. This is suddenly something I take ownership of. And it brings me, like, the feeling of pride where people will come up to you and be like, Smelts, you're never going to guess what I just sold. And I'm like, you know, it's killer. Like, you have back waiters selling dessert wine and stuff, and it just feels great.
Right.
You
know? They know what they're doing, and they feel good about it. What, at a place like this, it's a hip place. Checks are not cheap, but they're not crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I guess your goal is affordability to some extent.
Yeah,
you can't
sure.
go too crazy.
Totally.
And I guess in your mind, you want to make accessible to what you think works and introduce people. Is that what you did?
Yeah. I mean, I had a couple things in balance. It's definitely affordability. You know, like you can't, a lot of young people eat here too.
Yes.
And I think a lot of people kind of from all over the country and New York.
A lot of Europeans.
Yep. That too. Who are unaccustomed to seeing restaurant wine markup.
Manhattanites, Brooklynites that have the means, and then people that are exploring a great, you know, meal and all of that.
Totally. So my aim after a while and after watching sales and stuff was like, okay, $50 is the median. So that means, you know, write the list on a bell curve. You can't have $300 bottles on this list. There's no point. I mean, you can, but they're not going to move that fast. And everyone's buying between, you know, $45 to $75 bottles
of
wine.
That was a sweet spot.
So that's where you go. And there's so much wine at that price point that can be had that's remarkable. Like, not even just, like,
good, but really remarkable.
Even when you said you shifted to domestic, because U.S. domestic, I know there's a lot of good wine out there for good prices, but
it can be expensive.
I guess people think all the Napa stuff and Sonoma could be overpriced, but you find...
Yeah, it's like you carry wines from Mendocino and the Central Coast instead of Napa, and that's how you keep them affordable.
You pick the guys that know what they're doing.
Yep.
We'll talk about specific stuff there, because I really want you to sort of enlighten us on all that. All right, so you do that for 4 years. At some point, you get into a real stride. You got the wines on the shelf that you want. You got your people educated, the wines pairing well with all of that. You decide, for whatever reasons, it's time to leave.
Yep.
That was last year, middle of the year, and you have an opportunity, an interesting transition, to go from...
The pirate ship.
I was going to say, how do we describe it? The pirate ships to really, you know, one of the meccas of fine dining as far as brand name, owner, you know, that place.
Yeah, Empire.
You go to Empire. You go to Dinex, which is Daniel Balud's group. He opened a couple of cool places by Lincoln Center, Balud Sud and Bar Balud and Epicure Balud. So one's sort of a Mediterranean. The other is a bar with similar food. So now you get there. I'm talking too much. You get there because I want to hear from you, and you make this transition.
Yeah.
So tell me why you went there. Let's talk about the transition and, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah, so everyone's always really curious about the culture shock. I was prepared for it. I was prepared for it, but...
you can't see what Amanda's wearing, but she can't wear... She could wear what she's wearing today here to work, but she can't go to Balud Sud with that.
Yeah, I had to take off my suit jacket things when I got in here.
There you go.
Anyway, so part of it was that, you know, when I was here at Roberta's and at Blanca, I was the only one. Like, I had a team of sommeliers who were working under me who were, like, my pride and joy, and I loved working with them. But there was nobody here to teach me. I had kind of, you know, hit a little bit of a wall in terms of growth and development. And,
everybody learns and grows.
Yeah. And this is the first time, essentially, that I have ever been at a restaurant group that has multiple wine directors. You know what I mean? Like, Daniel Jonas, obviously, is the corporate wine director, but there are several restaurants in New York City in this restaurant group that have other head sommeliers doing, you know, their own programs. And I didn't have peers. You know, I've had peers in the industry, but at work, you know, like colleagues along those lines. And there were some things that I really wanted to learn and get better at, you know, like one of the...
So are you saying because of the other restaurants, they all were staffed with sommeliers, you were saying it excited you to know that Raj was at Danielle and whoever...
Edouard at Café.
It was sort of brotherhood, which you knew you could tap into.
Yep, and I also was thinking a lot about, you know, what are the things in the wine world that I'm not experienced enough in, you know? And when you shift away from fine dining, you get to do a whole bunch of avant-garde and fun and really playful stuff. But when you shift back into fine dining, you essentially gain access again to super classical wine and really traditional wine. And you know, there were some intellectual things that I kind of wanted to test myself with. And, yeah, I don't know. Part of it also is a native impulse that I have to throw shit at the wall and see what sticks. So,
well, let's talk about that, because you get there and there's a certain wine program that exists. I would say it's French centric.
Very.
You know, Burgundy, Rhones, and all of that. And that makes sense, and you keep that there. But you get in there and it's kind of your gig and you want to start tweaking stuff. So you're going from hipster cool to sort of mainstream staid. You got to stay in the game, but you want to do your thing. So what are the things you're doing, you know, when you get there?
Subterfuge. this is what it is. I became relatively known here for this whole natural wine thing, and
which we're going to talk about later, because that's huge.
Yep, it is. And the deal is that I know that the means of production that make really great natural wine are also present in some of those very classical places. Like, you learn it from certain Burgundians, and you learn it from certain Rhone farmers, and I know that. Not a lot of people know that, right?
So you mean they've been doing it as a practice.
Totally.
Without tooting and touting. The good ones.
This,
you know, we're biodynamic, we're organic, right. Whatever.
And you know, on the flip side, there are also lots of people in those classical regions who farm like crap. And, you know, so what I wanted was to be like, okay, you know, some of these big names, some of these icons should stay because Michael built that stuff here and there's no reason for you to take it down at all. But what about all these other little guys? What about all these other like small independent wineries that are in maybe lesser known appellations that represent amazing value, who are doing great farming? What about these, like, what about even these little guys in Burgundy that no one's ever heard of who are doing remarkable things in their cellar because they're young or they're, you know, I know the Burgundians sometimes like look down their nose a little bit at say the young negoces.
I was going to ask you that. I mean, there's a clientele there that goes to that restaurant and is used to
names,
you know, names in that list. Yep. Are they open to trying other stuff, or you kind of identify a younger customer and say, you want to try this?
Well, it's like, it's a sliding scale, right? So some people who are used to drinking only Louis Jadot, like very famous kind of mainstream Burgundy or whatever.
Those, you don't F with that guy?
You don't screw with it too much. Like you still let them have Burgundy, but maybe you like nudge them to try a younger producer. Right.
Finesse.
Yeah. And then if you've got people who seem really open from the moment you sit down, you let them drink natural wine from Burgenland in Austria.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it's
even a place like that. The clientele isn't look down your nose Burgundy only.
No. It's diverse. It's diverse.
When I go in there, I'd love to drink Burgundy, but I'm not interested. I want to try other stuff.
Yeah, it's diverse.
You know, I'm the perfect guy for you.
Yep. And I think one of the things that's been a pleasure to find and has been sort of a surprise is to see that even on the Upper West Side, you sometimes get people walking in the door who are like, what's this all about? And you're like, really? You're curious about that? And they're like, yeah. And I'm like, well, it's an unfiltered, hazy looking, you know, Grio from Sicily. How do you feel? And they're like, let's try it. And I'm like, okay. You know, so you just, if you keep an open mind, you find that there are others who will
and
too.
You know, try to read too.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, it requires finesse.
You know.
Yeah. It requires finesse.
Did you continue Michael's Big Bottle program?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How
every
come
night?
I don't get the email anymore? Did you stop emailing people?
No.
I'm still
trying to finesse Mikey's email list. I've got so many.
I got one when you got there and I haven't got one since.
We'll pick that thread back up.
When you said you came to Roberta's, one of the things you added was domestic wines. Did you carry that over?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
To Bar Balut and Balut's? What did you bring? You know, there's a place where you could bring in more expensive wines.
Yeah, totally.
What type of stuff did you bring in domestic-wise?
Well, I think one of the things I really want people on the Upper West to see, because they really do drink a lot of domestic wine, but they drink the same stuff over and over again. It's Napa Cab, Napa Chardonnay. It's
Camus, Insignia.
It's really like name check and name recognition. And I just want them to see like the Columbia Gorge, you know, which just see how diverse it is and see how vibrant winemaking in this country is right now. I get so excited, you know, because it's proliferating in this really remarkable way. So, you know, getting them outside of drinking, like just saying, I want Cabernet or I want Pinot Noir or I want Chardonnay, and that's it.
So are you, how long have you been there? It's been less than a year, right?
Yeah, it's I guess like 8 months now.
Are you near settled in to where you want to be with their list and the changes you want to make?
I think so. I mean, those things take time. Yeah.
Right. Like it'll always be ongoing.
Yeah, it's a moving target.
The changes are working and all of that stuff?
I think so.
Great. Those people should be exposed to that. So I want to talk to you. It's a good segue. I want to talk to you about certain types of wines.
Mm-hmm.
I'll jump ahead to natural wines. I mean, since I've done this show, the natural wine movement has been very prominent, prolific. But for the first time, the Raw Wine Fair came to Brooklyn.
Did you go?
I did go.
It's cool.
And my head was spinning.
I know. It was a lot of people.
For a guy who knew a little and wants to know a lot, you know, I couldn't take it in.
Sure.
So natural wines is something that you supported, introduced, continued to show here at Roberta's and at Bar Balut and Balut Sud, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you're at a fancier restaurant with bigger checks, does it change
the type of natural wines? I mean, do you do pet nats? Do you do orange wines?
Yes.
Do you
fewer.
Take it and not?
Fewer. Yes,
you do
but fewer. Yeah, I mean, you know, I want people to be able to see, you know, really great expressions of unique or to call them avant-garde styles. But I also don't mean to force it down anyone's throat.
Right.
Right. So it's like I'm totally happy to get, you know, Raphael Barrèche champagne in your glass, like really, which is expensive, but also beautiful. I'm totally happy to do that version of natural wine. Or I'm happy to do the Pet Nat from Santa Barbara that's got 2 inches of lees in it, but tastes like salt and rocks and is so great.
Right.
You know, all of that is... I'm very Catholic in my approach that way,
right.
You know? The only thing that's anathema to me is when the stuff is stripped raw with chemicals. And whether that happens in the vineyard or in the cellar, that's the stuff where when I hear people say, and I hear this all the time, all white wine tastes the same. The reason all white wine...
All natural white wine?
No, just
all
when,
white wine.
When people say to me, yeah, in conversation,
right.
They're like, I don't know, whatever. That, just give me a red or give me a white. Like, those are the two big categories. It all tastes the same. The reason people have that in their heads is because they've only ever been exposed to stuff that's made commercially.
Right.
You know, you've been drinking grocery store wine.
Right.
And there's nothing wrong with that because, look, that's how everybody comes to it, right?
Like, there's a bigger world out there.
There's a huge world out there of people who are tending their land in a really thoughtful way and who are exceedingly talented in the cellar, you know? And that is a different class of beverage. It's no longer just drink, you know?
How do you natural wine is a big sort of...
nebulous term, yeah.
How do you define it? And it's not about you being accurate to what the definition is. What's your interpretation of, you know, natural wine?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I like the way that Miss Le Peltier puts it in the opening page of her new wine list at Rouge.
She's coming on in a couple of weeks.
She's so great. I know everyone's a fangirl, but I'm just going to put it out there. Pasca, if you're listening, I'm a huge fangirl. No, she has a really nice way of kind of plainly describing it. There's organic farming where there's,
right.
You know, no chemicals used in the vineyard. That's a great step one for me, you know. Don't strip the nutrients out of the land. Then there are other dimensions and practices that come up, you know, where whether it's a really careful eye to sort of ecodiversity in your vineyards, which is where you're letting other animals live there, you're letting other things grow, you're finding what works for the vines in terms of their health, and sometimes that means discovering that letting other stuff be there is really important. You know, and all those farming practices are a little bit more holistic, a little bit more... sensitive maybe, and they're not on the industrial model, and that's the really important part to me.
And you had mentioned earlier that there have been wineries and winemakers that have done nothing but that.
Totally.
That's the way, you know, they function. There's
totally.
Even that whole Rudolf Steiner biodynamic, you know, which is another natural form of growing wine.
Mm-hmm.
So there is natural wines on the list at Balut Sud and Bar Balut.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so if you're up there, ask Amanda.
Mm-hmm.
Don't drink that white wine.
talk
to me about some lesser-known regions, some producers that are making great wines. This is where you could drop a little knowledge on my audience.
Yeah.
Give me regions. Give me winemakers. What comes to mind? You don't have to overload. I mean, if a few things come out, I'll be very happy.
Okay, I'm going to give you some of my favorites.
Do regions, then do winemakers.
Southern Spain, everyone should be drinking sherry. Everybody. And that's really funny because it's not necessarily natural wine. But.
So you're the first person who's advocating sherry since I've done the show, and I've had some good people. So sherry is...
Essentially not the sweet stuff that your grandmother's kept in their weird cabinet in the weird crystal decanter.
Right.
So that's the first thing.
Right.
That is...
It's not port.
It's not port. It is a fortified white wine that goes through an oxidative barrel aging process, usually in systems of barrels called soleras, where there's a lot of blending that happens. So it's got some resonances. It looks a little bit similar to things that happen in whiskey production and also things that sometimes happen in champagne production, which also happen to be two broad, very favorite categories of mine. So I always tell people that sherry, whether it's the really light, dry styles or the really dark, rich styles, is a great white wine for whiskey drinkers because it's got barrel notes, it's got some oxidative notes, it's got a little bit of extra booze.
So if you like them hot, it's got that
too.
Is it
a food wine or it's more of a sipping?
Both. So the darker styles.
Give me a natural pairing. You know, Muscadet oysters.
Totally.
Sherry.
Fino and crudo.
Crudo?
You go to a sushi restaurant with a bottle of Fino, great. You're going to be delighted.
All right, so sherry is a great tip. What kind of, give me the middle to lower end. What kind of price point are we talking about? And give me a maker or two.
Sure.
And go by availability.
Yeah. No, some of my favorites that are really, I mean, the amazing thing about sherry is that it's from a part of Spain where the economics are kind of roughed up. So they sell it for way less than what the wine
is worth.
So it's
a great value.
It's a great value. You can buy excellent Fino and Manzanilla for like nothing. It's as cheap as drinking beer. So that's another really big like point about it. Don't drink Budweiser. Drink Manzanilla. or drink Budweiser, but chase it with Manzanilla or whatever. Right. Some of my favorite producers are Maestro La Sierra.
Spell the Maestro. No, don't spell Maestro. Yeah. Maestro who?
La Sierra. So
S-I-E-R-A.
Yeah. R-R-A. Those wines are outstanding.
Okay.
Hidalgo La Gitana.
Carlos Santana.
Yeah, exactly.
Spell that for me.
Woman.
Spell that for me.
La Gitana is L-A and then G-I-T-A-N-A. Hidalgo La Gitana.
Yeah. Right.
Those are pretty widely available and are great.
So good wine store, New York.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, if you're in a major city, they probably have a little dusty shelf somewhere in the back
right. That's
got a Montiato hiding out on it,
off the
and
shelf.
You should totally go buy all of it.
All right, give me so I love that because I think that's interesting. Give me another region you love and give me some wines and a winemaker.
Okay, I love Germany.
Okay.
I love German wine. I like the big famous region of the Mosel very much, but I also like a lot of the lesser known regions in Germany.
Name two or three.
Baden, the Rheinhessen, and the Rheingau, let's say.
Right.
Which is funny because historically...
Rheingau is starting to come up.
Yeah, and historically the Rheingau was like an aristocratic place for wine.
We're going to taste a Riesling for our weekly wine sip.
Cool.
All right, so Germany, Rieslings, mm-hmm. and those... There's the whole range. There's mm-hmm. some great cheaper stuff,
yep.
and there's a real art like Donhoff to some really famous guys.
Yep.
All right, give me one more. Give me one more region.
Let's say Sicily.
Sicily.
Yep. Let's say especially Etna. Other places too, but especially Etna.
The predominant grape is
For reds, Nerello Mascalese, which is an indigenous variety that is just from that place.
What's the characteristic of that grape? Big?
Well, it depends on how you make it. I think it's more like a Grenache or a Pinot Noir, where it's really about like fineness and not so much about mass, like massive weight. But you can, depending on how you handle it, you can push it into big, broad territory too. So they range from like medium to full, I'd say.
Cool.
Yeah.
And Sicily tends to produce wines that are a good value.
Mm-hmm. And that's the same thing, kind of economically struggling. So what that means is they sell really
right.
high quality stuff
right.
for, lower prices.
So let's review. We have sherry,
mm-hmm.
we have German wines, and we have Sicilian wines.
That's a nice meal to me.
Three great directions and something we don't always hear about. Amanda, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to subject you to our wine list, which is a bunch of questions.
Cool.
You can help us with that. And then I'm going to make you drink some wine for our wine sip.
The worst.
We're going to evaluate it, and then we're going to wrap up, and we're out of here in a little while. So you're listening to The Grape Nation. We're talking to Amanda Smeltz. We'll be back in a few seconds or minutes.
Today's program is brought to you by the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, period. Why? Lush grasslands, glacial water supply, fourth generation cheesemakers, combining old world tradition with the new ideas and highest standards. The very best milk. What do you think of when you think of Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds. Delicious, fresh cheese curds. Or deep-fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Upland's Cheese Company, the operation behind the Pleasant Ridge Reserve cheese that's literally America's most awarded cheese. I think of the deliciously stinky Limburger and its long-storied history. I think about Raleigh's Dumbarton Blue, a perfect blend of English-style cheddar and notes of blue. I think of Emmy Roth's Grand Cru Sirsois, which was named 2016's World Champion at the World Championship Cheese Contest. Wisconsin is like the world champion of cheese, and once you start reading the list of cheeses made in Wisconsin on their website, you can see why. The Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board is a nonprofit organization funded entirely by Wisconsin's dairy farm families. Read more at eatwisconsincheese.com, and as soon as you're done listening to this podcast, eat Wisconsin cheese. It's a no-brainer.
All right, we're back. We're back with my guest, Amanda Smeltz. Amanda is the head sommelier at Bar Balloud and Balloud Sud up by Lincoln Center in New York City. We are now going to subject Amanda to our wine list, and let's see what she's drinking. So the first question is, what are you drinking now? And I don't mean I just gave you some reason.
In the glass.
What's the stuff in the last week, couple of weeks that you keep drinking over and over or trying or liking now?
Well, I'm going to try not to be too trendy, but I can't help
no,
it.
No. Don't. There's no barrier here.
Okay. So I was very fortunate. In May of last year, I got to go to Austria with a wine importer to visit a couple producers there. And I was very fortunate to get to visit this young couple in Burgenland at a winery called Gutogau in the small village.
That's the faces on the labels?
It's the faces on the labels.
That's a hot wine.
It's a hot item, and it is funny because it...
So it's Gut, G-U-T, Ogau, O-G-G-A-U. It's available... Not easy to find. It's in cool bars and restaurants.
Yeah, for sure. But they represent a sort of changing tide in the production of Burgenland wine in Austria. And it's kind of cool because they work with grape varieties that are native there. So, like, they've got Grüner Veltliner, maybe something you've heard of before. They've got Blaufränkisch, you know, the
those
grape,
are the two biggies
kind of big,
in
biggies
Austria.
In Austria, for sure. But they have all these other grape varieties that grow well there. And the wines are just remarkable. They are... profoundly fresh, they feel like vibrating.
They're natural too. They were at the wine fair. I remember
they're like vibrating and energetic,
right.
You know. And they
so
just
it's Gut, G-U-T, Ogau, O-G-G-A-U. If you see them on a wine list or in a store, grab one.
Snap,
I agree
snap
with Amanda.
Those up.
All right, you got to go a little quicker on your answers.
Okay, here I go.
Favorite, and I think you may have said this earlier. Favorite wine and food pairing.
I might say Girard wine and oysters.
Okay. Like a Sauvignon?
Yep. Or like Van Jean and oysters.
Okay.
Incredible together.
Okay, so that's sort of a lot of people say Muscadet and oysters, mm-hmm. Champagne. That's a good choice. The Jura, J-U-R-A, is a region of France that's very hot right now, and they're making some terrific wines there. And they're great seafood wines.
Mm-hmm.
All right, give me, separate of where you work, your favorite wine, restaurant, and or bar. You're not incriminating or playing favorites. Mm-hmm. What's a place where
I totally play favorites.
Place that has a great list, great people.
New York City or everywhere?
New York, and then I'll take an everywhere,
okay,
too.
Okay, New York City, Rouge Tomat, hands down.
Okay, I agree with you.
Yep.
I think it's interesting. She's the best.
Yep.
And the food's terrific.
Totally. I'll also throw a second nod in there. Even though I don't get to Tribeca often, I think the Terroir wine list is fantastic.
That's Paul
yep.
Greco. Yeah. I think he's sort of the granddaddy.
He's a guru.
Yeah,
totally.
He is the guru. All right. Now, you said just New York, so you have something outside of New York?
Man, there are so many cool places to drink in this country and elsewhere now. It's
give me
amazing.
One.
Walrus and the Carpenter in Seattle.
Okay.
Great wine list
All right.
Delicious food.
You want to throw me one more?
Sure. Where else do I love to drink? Let's say upstate in Hudson.
That's a hot area.
Like around the
restaurants.
Brunette
and
wine bar.
Tiny,
tiny, adorable, great list.
So if you're traveling north to go skiing or you're going up to Rhinebeck or Saugerties or Woodstock, it's not far from there. Brunette mm-hmm. Wine Bar. All right. Favorite all-time wine?
Oh, that is so hard.
And how if could you I can't give me one, give me one or two.
Favorite all-time wine.
There's got to be something you drank that.
Yeah, sure. Okay, there are two. One is a shout-out to Mike Madrigal, because I have him to thank for this.
Okay.
Because Noël Versailles in...
Champagne?
In Cornas.
Cornas.
In the Northern Rhone. I was lucky enough to open a 1998 Cornas of his a couple months back with one of my psalms there. And it was really, like, hauntingly beautiful.
So Noël Versailles, V-E-R-S-E-T, mm-hmm. that's... The Northern Rhone?
Yeah, exactly.
That's Cornas, which is a region. They make a type of Cornas, St. Joseph. I'm surprised he didn't say a Gonon St. Joseph.
Gonon's really good, yeah.
And what year did you say?
2000.
Okay, and it was...
It's spectacular.
It racked you?
Yeah, it just has one of... It smells like a folk tale. You know, you're like...
Whatever that means.
You know, I don't know, but it's how Whatever I felt.
All right, that's a good one. That's got a lot of... passion behind it. All right, best wine under $15. Mm-hmm. I need a red and a white. I need the 15 retail, and you got to dig on this.
Okay, best wine white is easy for me. Weiser Künstler's entry level Riesling, hands down. Every
so
year.
Künstler, K-U-N-T-S-L-E-R,
K-U-N-S-T-L-E-R.
Künstler.
Yep. So Weiser is the first part of the name.
W-E-I-S-E-R.
Yeah, exactly. Weiser Künstler. Their wines are beautiful.
So if you're going Riesling and you're going in that price range, yep. you're going wine. That's the play.
That's I think they're superior.
Perfect.
Yep.
What about a red?
Under 15 bones.
That's tough.
It's harder because red wines fetch higher prices. I would go. Honestly, maybe like. No, that's not true. Oh, there's.
You got to talk to me now.
I'm
yourself.
Sorry. I'm in my brain. I'm in my own brain right now. Honestly, in the Piedmont, you can get great value still. You can get like Barbera d'Asti or Barbera d'Alba for under that price point. If you get the right producer, those wines are gorgeous.
I agree. Yeah. If you go to a good Italian restaurant, you can get it on the list for not a lot of money.
Totally.
So you're looking at $15 to $20 mm-hmm. for Piedmont wines, which is northern Italy. And Barbera d'Asti, A-S-T-I, mm-hmm. and d'Alba?
A-L-B-A, yep.
A-L-B-A, look for those. All right, those are good choices. All right, do you have favorite psalms you love and admire? We mentioned Michael.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you that. He's a friend.
Mm-hmm.
Pascaline.
Yep.
I'll give you that. So let's get out of those two. Who's out there that you admire that's doing it right?
There is a woman in Portland who I just think the end of the world
is
of.
Is that that Walrus place?
No. That's in Seattle.
Seattle.
She just opened her own spot called Dame in Portland. And her name is Dana Frank. And her taste is so close to what I think is, she's just like got her finger on a pulse and her restaurant is beautiful. And
Her name is Dana?
Dana Frank.
Frank,
yeah,
and
I think
the place is?
Dame.
Dame, D-A-M-E.
Yep. Lady Bar.
So if you're out there, that's somebody who knows wine is recommending somebody who knows wine too. All right, so you did an admirable job on our wine list.
Okay.
We're very good. All right, we're going to move to our weekly wine sip. Every week we taste a different wine on air. For our weekly wine sip this week, we're going to taste the 2015 Nick Weiss St. Urban's Hof Riesling. It's estate bottled from old vines, and it's from the Moselle region of Germany. The wine retails for about $15 to $17. And it's readily available in better wine stores. Normally, I ask our guests, tell me a little more about this. But when I showed Amanda the wine, she goes, what is that?
He stumped me.
So the good news is we're going to taste this wine together on the air, and we're going to see if we like it or not. So let's start with color. Is that a typical Riesling, lighter, darker?
Yeah, it's right in strike zone. It's got like a little bit of a yellowy tinge to it, you know, which shows a touch of ripeness.
Okay.
But
let's go nose.
Yep.
Were you going to say something else?
No. Smells like flowers, which is good because Rieslings should always have some kind of
floral
note. Yep.
Anything else on the nose?
Honey, which is great too. Another indicator of a little bit of ripeness.
Yes.
And then my favorite note in Rieslings of all time, which is rock. It smells like a wet rock.
So minerality or rock? Is there a difference between?
Same, but I find that in Mosel Riesling, when they're good, it usually smells wet, which is really nice.
A whetstone.
Yep.
Right. Which definitely smells different than a stone that's been sitting in the sun. Mm-hmm. I agree with you. All right. So that's the nose. Mouthfeel, typical Riesling. Is it light? Is it heavy? Is it, does it have the right?
It is correct.
What like, about the acidity?
It's good. And that's, and that is really a key feature for me on Riesling. If it doesn't have acid, it's not doing the thing it's supposed to do.
Now, a lot of people, you know, they...
Riesling's sweet.
Right. Riesling is sweet. There are different levels of Riesling, all the way to a dessert wine that's very sweet. This is considered a dry Riesling. Is this dry? This is not a sweet for a dry Riesling. This
bone
is
dry.
Not too... So it's a bone dry, which yep. is, you know, what we wanted, which is a good thing. All right. Let's talk about the taste and the palate. What are we getting on that?
Super tart, which is awesome, because that's what a lot of people don't expect. The tartness and the acid kind of work together to make things, to make it feel like really refreshing. And then even though the nose has got flowers and honey on it, instead it tastes like a lemon rind. And maybe with some like herbal, little bit of herbs in there too.
So everything you're saying, is that sort of a classic profile for Riesling, or are
for,
we straying?
For dry Riesling in the Mosel, yes.
So it's yep. hitting inside the box.
Totally.
Which is good. Give me some taste descriptors.
So definitely that lemon rind thing that you got. I also noticed how the tartness and the acid work together to kind of pucker your mouth a little
yeah,
bit.
Yeah, there's a little pucker.
Which means it's going to be great for food. It's going to kind of clean your palate
so
up.
So that was my
eating.
Next question. Yep. What's our good best pairing for this?
Pork.
Pork.
Yeah. Yeah, I would go like
is
pork
that
sausage
typical Riesling or this particular wine this, holds up?
This one, I think, has got the right things, right? It's the same reason that we do like apples on pork dishes is really traditional.
Right.
This
that
is the same
sweetness
deal.
To offset.
It's a little bit
what
of like
kind
acid.
Of pork? Pork loin?
I would do like pork sausage came to mind right away.
So sausage would be good.
There's
with
an
this.
Herbal thing here that would
bratwurst,
be awesome. Totally.
Sauce, okay.
Totally. Good cool. barbecue wine, actually. Like
okay.
grilling out.
It would hold up against mm-hmm. all that stuff. All right, so this is the 2015 Nick Weiss St. Urban's Hof Riesling. Look at me, Uncle Sammy, turning Amanda onto a wine she never had before.
He did it.
She forgot what I know, and I just introduced her to a wine.
Getting schooled.
Do we like this wine?
I just took another swig of it, so the answer is assuredly
yes. Do we think
yes.
it's a good value yeah. for 15, 17
yeah.
bucks?
Absolutely. I'd be very pleased with this if I spent 15 bones in a store and took this home.
All right, so... One of the things we should learn from Amanda is that think a little out of the box. Sherry, she brought up. Riesling, we just tasted one, and it's a terrific food wine. It's got some nice characteristics and a few other wines. So that's the 2015 Nick Weiss St. Urban's Hof Riesling. I'm glad we liked it. All right, we're going to wrap up, Amanda. If you have a question, a wine happening or event, hit me up at Sam at the Grape Nation. That's Sam at the Grape Nation. Follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation, Twitter at Ben Ruby, and Instagram at S Ben Ruby. Finally, on our wine calendar, we have Riesling Fire.
Fire? Yeah.
Okay. Riesling Fire is the greatest celebration of German wine on earth. It's coming to New York City February 17th and 18th. Go to Riesling Fire, that's R-I-E-S-L-I-N-G, that's how you spell Riesling. One word, fire, which is German for fair, F-E-I-E-R.com. So it's RieslingFire.com for more info on tastings, seminars, and dinners. And for the dinners, they bring in some of the best sommeliers in New York to serve and help. And Amanda was there and will be there this year. So if you have any interest in German wine, they have a walk-around tasting. They have a dinner, which there's still tickets available for, and there's still a few seminars open.
I will just do a little plug for it. That dinner is one of the best BYO parties on the planet.
Right,
so.
It is a BYO. So that's pretty cool. All right, so we want to thank our guest, Amanda Smeltz, head sommelier at Bar Balud and Balud Sud. We want to thank our engineer, Vitor, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Ben Ruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation. We'll see you next week.
for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.